This is Gutcast. Living with IBD means having to carefully plan life events such as a wedding or even a midweek night out to a local restaurant. Although we need a little bit of planning, there are plenty of tips to ensure you can still make the most of these family and social occasions. I'm thrilled to chat with Lorraine Cooney, a dietitian with a special interest in IBD, Jennifer Wilson O'Reilly, Principal Clinical Psychologist at Beaumont Hospital, and Ruth Nugent, a race car driver living with Crohn's disease. Ruth, can I start by asking, what was your diagnosis experience like? Did it take long for you?
Yeah, it was May 2015, so I would have been 21. And I'd been trying to find out what had been going on with me for about 2 years at that stage. And I kind of had a couple of misdiagnoses, and eventually it was kind of a state of get biopsies done. And then that was when I was told, and I just never forget sitting in the chair and being, you know, just kind of said, look, I'm really sorry to tell you, you have Crohn's disease. And I'd never heard of it before. So I just sat there and was like, right, okay, yeah. So what do we do? Like, and he was like, no, like, you know, just kind of give you a history. You know, we don't know what causes it. There's no cure. But I just remember like just going blank. I was just like, what is happening? Do you know what I mean? So that was kind of when I started going online, go back to my GP, find ISCC and everything like that. But it was very daunting in the beginning. And I was only 21 as well. So it was a bit like, I was just, it was life changing, but like, I don't mean to make it sound so dramatic. It was kind of like it happened really slowly. Do you know, it starts to sink in that like everything's that like these things that you've been feeling and aren't going to go away as such.
Yeah. And what kind of stuff, like what kind of symptoms, I suppose, were you experiencing up until that point? Would it have been as early as childhood or teenage years?
Yeah. So it was teenage years that it kind of started. I just started getting stomach problems and I was just really sick all the time. I was really run down. I was catching anything that was going around. And we found out that I had a B12 deficiency as well. But my stomach was just, my stomach just wasn't right. There was foods that just weren't agreeing with me, but I was really tired all the time. It just didn't add up really. And then when you get to the stage where say you're passing blood and stuff like that, you're like, okay, something's not okay here. So it was kind of when I was about 19 that my mom was like, look, I really prefer if we go get this checked out properly and stuff like that. So like my granddad's a GP and my mom was a medical secretary. So they'd be quite looped in and quite like, you need to talk about this and everything. It just got really bad actually within the 2 years that I was looking for a diagnosis to figure out what was going on. I don't know, I ended up in A&E at one stage and I was losing weight and then I couldn't keep stuff down. My stomach was just, I don't know how to describe it. You know yourself, like it was like constant symptoms and everything just seemed to pile up and you just got to the stage where you were like, is this all in my head? Do you know what I mean? Like, is what's happening here? It was just a really hard time, to be honest. It was hard for my family as well. I'm an only child and my mom, dad and I are very close and they were just really, really upset about it and everything. So it was just hard really at the time. Like in hindsight, I think at the time you're kind of just, you go through it. But then, you know, like as time goes, you kind of just learn to cope in your own different ways, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I can identify with so much of what you're saying there, Ruth, because, you know, you're right. When you get that diagnosis, you're like relieved. It's not in my head. I have an answer now. I can begin to, you know, make a plan for the future. But then you do start looking back on that time. And it is traumatic for an awful lot of people because you're just trying to get through it and you're trying to like get an answer. You get the answer and it's a couple of months later that, you know, God, I really went through that. And, you know, that was actually very, very hard.
Kind of like the classic thing as well of like, oh, I'm going to go to the doctor and they're going to give me something to take and it's all going to be grand and off we go.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I was expecting. I don't know, like call me naive or whatever. I was just hoping for the best, but it didn't happen that way. And it was just, I just didn't expect it really, I think. And yeah, I don't think anybody does, like, well, unless it's like in your family, which it isn't in mine. So it really was just such a surprise. And it's such a disappointment because it was like, right, okay, you start to realize that you're going to be on this journey for the rest of your life. Like you're going to be, it's just going to be a different scenario altogether than what you originally hoped for, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole go to hospital, get better and move on with your life just doesn't apply to us. And
I think that's so Irish though too, isn't it? You're like, yeah, head to the GP, they'll give us a pill and off we go. Like
it is.
Like, can I just break in here? Because that is not just Irish. I got it.
Okay, that's good to know, Jenny.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, I know I'm here to speak about psychology and I don't want to like, you know, put labels on people or whatever, but I just want to speak because this is such a beautiful example that you're both describing of, you know, what we would call in my business adjustment, which we all kind of know what that means. But when we're thinking about adjustment in chronic illness, it's like everybody has that model, just exactly what you're describing for acute illness. You know what I mean? Like if you've been healthy, you have this idea that you get sick, you go to the doctor, you get your, you know, your diagnosis, your prescription, you take it, and then you're stopped being sick. And one of the major tasks following diagnosis is adjusting to the idea that this isn't an acute illness, that it is chronic. And that is just, I'm so sorry to break in. This is no, like a beautiful no. moment between the two yeah. of you.
You're it's so also just busy. Nice to hear it from an expert that like we're not
that we're normal
exactly
and that it's not just Irish, right? Like this is part of like everybody has that model in their head. I mean, if they're lucky to have been healthy as a child, right? And it's like this myth that we have some control over our bodies, you know, all that kind of stuff goes with it. And then suddenly you're in this space, you've got your diagnosis, it's a big relief like you described, but then the next task is, you know, how can I be with something that's chronic, that's not, that there's never going to be a time when I can not think about this aspect of who I am. I mean, there might be a time when it's like right in front of me, and there might be other times when it's a little bit out in the periphery, but it's always there. And so I just, you know, and that's exactly what you guys are describing. So it's not just Irish. I just got to say.
That great.
So normal to know that. Like, that's actually, I hope you don't mind me saying, but like, about 2 years ago, I kind of like hit a low point with my mental health, a lot better now, like managing it a lot better and stuff. But I remember when I first started seeing my therapist and stuff, I was like, you know, naming these things that happened in your life and going through everything. And then I was like, oh yeah. And then I was diagnosed with Crohn's, you know, and blah, 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 and everything. And she was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like what? Like that's massive. And I was like, ah, yeah, but you know, you just, and then she was like, no, no, no. Like what happened? How did you cope with it and everything? And then I was realizing like how it was still, this was 2 years ago, so I was 25. So it was 4 years after diagnosis. And I was still actually only kind of coming to terms with it. Like I was kind of brushing it off at that stage. But when we kind of broke it down and stuff, it's still accepting that this isn't going away. Like you have this for the rest of your life and stuff. And I never forget that because I was like, oh, it's 4 years later, like I'm coping, I'm grand. I wasn't actually, I was still kind of slowly accepting what was happening mentally. Like,
yeah, like it's so important. Like it's a huge thing. I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for the journey that we go through. I think in previous episodes of Gutcast, we talk about managing every day. But I think a really important point that we want to also acknowledge is like we are people who have huge milestones, huge achievements, huge things happening in our lives. And, you know, IBD is for a lot of us is front and center. It's usually when something big is happening in your life. It's like one of the first things that comes to mind of, OK, how is my IBD got to be part of this? Jennifer, if I can ask you, one difficult aspect of IBD is constantly having to make choices that others would never have to make. For example, how will I spend the limited amount of energy I have today? What will need to be sacrificed? How do you manage these situations to ensure that you're being kind to yourself and not overstretching?
Okay, Amy, I got some ideas about this.
Good. I'm all ears.
The first thing I got to do, and I'm sorry about a little bit of pushback, but first thing I got to do is just kind of challenge that idea that other people aren't trying to make choices too. Because one of the things that can happen for us when, you know, when we have a chronic condition, or even if we have some kind of life event that pushes us off our game or, you know, whatever it is, we can have a thought like, everybody else seems okay. You know, there's something wrong with me that I'm having to manage this, or there's something wrong with, you know, me that I'm not coping the way that other people are coping. And I suppose I see that a lot in the people that I meet with, is almost like a sense of isolation. And isolation and kind of shame can be very closely connected. So I just want to kind of challenge that idea of, because it's something that we all do when we look around and we say everybody else, you know, seems to be doing okay. And chronic conditions are pervasive in our community. You know, 50% of people over 50 have at least one chronic condition, you know? So So sorry for that, Amy, a little bit of
No, it's good. It's so important to highlight, though, because you can, when you are someone live with an illness, you can focus in and think you're the only one, perhaps in your friend group or your family group. So I think it's really important to highlight that, Jenny. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you're very kind to me. Thank you. But then the second part of your question is like, how do we make choices? And I'm really interested in this area for a couple of different reasons. One of them is fear, and the other one is compassion. But I want to talk a little bit about fear, because one of the things that we know about quality of life with chronic conditions is that fear-based decision-making can actually really impact on quality of life. So that kind of what if, what if I, can't cope tomorrow if I do this, or what if I embarrass myself, or what if I can't find the right facility, or what if, those kinds of fear motivators for making decisions, that can be really, really challenging. And one thing that can happen to people is that if they're responding around a fear-based motivator, is that their lives can get kind of smaller and smaller. You know, they're trying to control the environment to reduce their anxiety and fear, but at the same time they're doing that, they're cutting out potential for learning and growth and social, contacts, and making mistakes, which is part, and having difficult situations, which is like part of life. So that's the fear piece. The other piece is compassion. And some of the really, and like you mentioned, kind of how do we be kind to ourselves, that kind of self-compassion. And some of the more recent research around compassion, there's a researcher called Kristen Neff, who's really interesting to me at the moment. And she talks about compassion in a way that I find really valuable, because often when we think about compassion, we think about gentle compassion. But the other component of compassion is what she would call fierce compassion, which is the part of us that kind of pushes ourselves, you know, that challenges ourselves, or that challenges other people, that says, actually, you know, that response is not okay, or I'm not putting up with that anymore, you know? And I find it really valuable to think about those two pieces as being part of compassion, the gentle and also the fierce. And so just coming back to making a choice, sometimes we're quite compassionate when we push ourselves, and particularly around fear-based decision-making, that it can be quite compassionate to say, you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. But not always. Sometimes it's also compassionate to say, you know what, I'm not doing this and I'm going to do something different, you know, to actually take a minute to evaluate and say, you know, what is the best way to approach this?
I think that's such a good point about saying no. I was such a yes person, and Ruth's head is nodding as well. And you get involved in everything. In recent years, I've learned to take a step back and be selective about how I will use my energy. Lorraine, from a dietitian's perspective, can you tell us about managing diet with IBD? I normally read through a restaurant menu in advance, but the level of preparation may obviously not always be possible. What advice do you have for people attending a private function, like a wedding, for example?
Yeah, there's a lot in this question, and eating out or those big events can be majorly challenging for a lot of people with inflammatory bowel disease. I like the point you make about studying the menu. So you can search all the menus online and restaurants these days, so you can look beforehand, and don't be shy about calling a restaurant. People are with food allergies would call a restaurant all the time, so they are used to this, and ask them how you would modify a dish for you to suit your needs, whether it's making it low fat or gluten free or lactose free, whatever the case may be, that's really doable. And then you can decide what you're going to eat beforehand, which does take a lot of the stress and anxiety out of the whole experience. And knowing your triggers, I mean, that's work that you can do behind the scenes. If you know what your triggers are, you can go to restaurants that have extensive menus, and that will have a higher possibility of meeting your needs. For some people, they can eat out and enjoy Indian or Mexican, but for other people, they would feel more comfortable having a bland diet. So it's very individual. And things that may be in your control, if you know where you're going to eat, you can choose to eat at off-peak times or ask for a table near the bathroom. And from experience, you can evaluate how did you get on with that restaurant or that experience, and see what worked and what doesn't work. and that can add to your confidence in eating out. And it is about relaxing, you know, if you kind of think you're going to go somewhere and set yourself up that things are going to go wrong, then you're sort of prepping your body and all the systems for the worst. And as we know, stress can wreak havoc on IBD. So even though it's hard, you've got to try and look at it as going to be a pleasurable experience. So having a positive attitude can go a long way. When you get there and you get your meal, I know you've probably heard it all before, but you know, chewing your food and taking your time eating can be really helpful for digestion and your digestive system. And taking some deep breaths before the meal can really help set the scene as well for you. I think another point dietetically would be try not to skip meals prior to going somewhere and eating out, and keep your regular routine prior to the event.
One thing when eating out, and from talking to a lot of people with IBD, I think, you know, we put so much trust in other people when we eat out. And I think is that something that you would have experienced with clients, Lorraine, or heard from people, you know, that, you know, you're really kind of trusting other people to really get your illness and, you know, the impact it has on you, because a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah, I know. It really depends on the scenario and where you're going to be and who you're going to be with. So if you're going to somebody else's house, then it's great if you can ask them what's going to be on the menu, so that, you know, you'd be confident in eating it. Or maybe you can add that you're going to bring the dessert or you're going to bring the sides. Or you can say, well, I'm not really sure. How about I host and everyone comes to my house? So that gives you back the control of what's going on. But how other people react to you, and, you know, it can be triggering for some people if people are asking you what you're eating, or are you not eating that, or why are you doing this, or won't you have a bit of this? And that can be hard sometimes when you just want to do your own thing. And there's no right or wrong. It's not your fault that you have inflammatory bowel disease, but it's up to you what you want to do. Do you want to eat like everybody else, or do you want to stick to your restrictive diet? That's your decision to make. But it can be hard to navigate all of that, and probably gets better over time once you learn more about your body and your triggers and where you go and what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. Ruth, would you identify with a lot of what Lorraine and Jenny said there?
Yeah, I can definitely relate to everything, really. But what you were saying about giving your energy, like I do believe strongly in giving your energy where it's going to be reciprocated. And whether it's like physically or emotionally or whatever, I just think that your energy can be so limited with IBD. And it's just really, really important to make sure that you're only going to give it where you're going to get it back. And I just think that applies to everything. And then there was something that Jenny mentioned that reminded me of some of the stuff by Brené Brown. Have you ever, the Call to Courage and stuff. Everything about like how she's like, she made me see vulnerability as strength. And that's kind of, that was like a turning point for me about 2-3 years ago. When I first kind of read all about that and everything, like literally I used to see myself as vulnerable as somebody with Crohn's disease, and just her perspective on everything made me see it completely differently. Like literally you're at your strongest when you're most vulnerable, because that's kind of where there's going to be a point of change coming. And everything you were saying kind of reminded me of that, Jenny.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that, Ruth. I think it's just so powerful what you said. Thank you for bringing that in.
It is important. And, you know, this is all about milestones, and it's all about, you know, those moments in time. And like a milestone can be anything, because even I remember a big milestone after diagnosis, after getting exposed to treat at the time, a big milestone for me was actually getting out of a chair in 1 second, because pre-diagnosis, it took me about 15 minutes to literally get out of a chair. But to me, it was like, I'm getting better to some degree. And Jennifer, would that be something that you would see with people with IBD, that it's not always the negative things? It could be any sort of an emotion that can trigger, I suppose, symptoms in people.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, safety is not feeling anything. You know, I mean, it's subtracting change, it's staying away from other people. Like those things are all really safe in a way, right? But they're so dangerous in other ways. And as soon as you, like kind of what Ruth was saying with vulnerability, but as soon as you're experiencing strong emotion, as soon as you're interacting with people, whether it's, you know, conflict or engagement, you know, whatever that is, your body's responding to that. I mean, that's what our bodies are designed to do. So we have thoughts, we have emotions, and we have physical reactions to any stressor, whether it's a positive or a negative stressor. And it's like kind of balancing the engagement with the celebration, with the awareness that, you know, I might have to pay for this in a different way. And that, you know, that's tricky, but there's something also beautiful about the fact that you were in this and it was so amazing. You know, that's part of engagement, is the physical piece as well. So yeah, of course it is. And I mean, one of the things like bereavement, you know, bereavement's a huge one where it's so sad, but people forget bereavement is a physical experience. And very often people would get flares or exacerbations of whatever ongoing condition that they have following the loss of someone cherished, you know? So obviously our yeah, I could say the same thing over and over again, but our engagement with the world has consequences for sure.
Totally.
I can relate to this so much, Amy. Like, I'm just thinking about, obviously, between my own hobbies, I'm an adrenaline junkie. Seek the adrenaline, seek the serotonin, right? So my body cannot still, after these couple of years, identify the difference between excitement and nerves. So it just reacts to the excitement as bad as it does the nerves. Yeah. Like, genuinely, on race days and stuff, I am the worst. Like, and it would, like, my mom and my dad have always been like, you know, you could almost do with a week off after a race weekend because my body's trying to wind down and I'm always so sick afterwards. And it's all excitement. Like, obviously there's a bit of nerves, but mainly excitement, but my body is like panic and let's just do the worst things that we could possibly do to her. And I'm like, worst timing, but it's a good thing happening, but my body reacts that way. And I've had similar experiences, just basically where they've brought me so much happiness, but my body been like, oh, about it. And I'm like, oh, right. Okay. So it likes it when I'm happy and likes it when I'm sad. It reacts. Like, I think if we've anybody with kind of a chronic illness, your body is hypersensitive. I don't know if you guys have found that, but I have. Like, my body is so hypersensitive to everything. So I can just resonate so much with what you're saying. Yeah.
But, you know, to bring it back to home, even just like recording a podcast, and like, this is our series 3 and my stomach still gets, and it's like that differentiating between the good and the bad emotions. But Ruth, just to pick up on the point that you said there about, you know, the adrenaline rush and, you know, the effects that it has on you the day of a race day. Can you talk me through, you know, what that day could look like for you and how do you manage that? Because that's like, you're in a car. Like, it's not as if you can just leg it to a bathroom if there is a situation. Oh, so what do you do?
Yeah, there's no situation like that. Well, to be honest, there was a lot of what Lorraine was saying as well that I could relate to when it came to like knowing kind of for foods and stuff like that, knowing the foods that I can eat or can't eat, knowing what's available to the place I'm going, so the racetrack I'm going to be at. It starts from the night before. I think I kind of would have to just start, like, my stomach would be quite bad and I'd be nervous and everything, and it carries into the next day, and it's just excitement and nerves combined, you know. And the next morning, like, my stomach's always very, very bad. And it's just because I'm, you know, the typical kind of pre-race nerves and everything. So I may have certain things that I'll take. I know that I can't eat very well on race days, like my stomach. And even though I know that I need to fuel my body, so I'll definitely eat soft foods. Like, I don't know if you guys, like, when you're in a flare, I eat very soft foods because they're easier on my stomach, but they'll still give me kind of the energy and electrolytes that I need. Like, so I kind of, I always go with my dad, and of course my dad know me obviously inside out, so I'd be quite transparent with him as to what I need and when I need it and everything, what's happening. So he'd be very helpful and everything. But I'd even kind of, most of the time, I'd have like a hot water bottle with me right from the second I've left the house, kind of have it on my stomach to just try relax the muscles and just try and relax myself and kind of just distract my mind from the excitement. And then the mornings of race days are very stressful because you have to get the car through scrutiny, you have to sign on, you have to kind of get your ducks in a row, basically. And then comes, you know, straight away you're going to be doing practice and then qualifying. And of course you want to qualify well and everything. So that's when the pressure kind of comes in. So dad will always know where the toilets are before we've gone. So like, we'll try park close enough to toilets where it's going to be accessible. Put something small on my stomach and then kind of just get in and get going. But when I'm in the car, to be honest, like, right up until right up, and especially in a race, like right until the lights go out and I have to go, I feel like I'm going to get sick. But I think that's kind of normal for a lot of people in adrenaline sports. But like definitely Crohn's wise, you're like, I don't know what's going to happen here. It might not be good. Like it's a lot. I'm too stubborn though as well. Like I wouldn't kind of turn around and be like, oh, I'll just miss this heat because my stomach's too sore. I'm like, it'll be fine. Let's go. Like we've got this. I'm way too stubborn, to be honest.
It's a great attitude to have though, Ruth, because, you know, it ties into not letting our illness define us, or, you know, still being able to experience the things we want to experience in life, you know, which.
Yeah. Oh, big time. Like, I mean, the whole diagnosis is kind of what gave me the kick up the bum to just be like, go and live the life that you want to live, really. I was like, you know, I was really stuck in kind of a wallowing for a good while. And then eventually I was like, no, there's these things I want to do. I've always wanted to do it. Like, let me just save up and go. And like 3 years later, it's the best thing I ever did. It's really brought out everything in me and shown me my own strength in different ways, like even just coping with IBD on a race day and everything. And yeah, I just try to be as transparent about it as possible, even in that sense. Like I've even met people within the paddock who've come up to me and been like, oh, you spoke about this in social media before, and my son has Crohn's disease, or I have ulcerative colitis and all this kind of thing. Like, and I just, that's to me was what it's all about being transparent, even within my sport, you know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely. Lorraine, to bring you in, just in relation to what Ruth was talking there, you know, the prep in relation to, you know, her race days. And I'd love to find out if there's any kind of prep advice that you and Jennifer would have in relation to, you know, an upcoming milestone. You know, as I said, we got engaged. So then therefore, in my example, we have to plan a wedding. And I actually, you know, when you're talking to people, they're like, oh, do you have a date? And we're like, yeah, May 2023. And they're like, oh great, you'll have to start planning that. And I'm like, oh, I have everything booked. And people think I'm just eager beaver, and I'm not. It's like, I'm like, no, but I have to plan a long time in advance, because I could actually be really sick and not make it to my wedding day. And that's my reality, and that's what I'm trying to avoid. And even things like going dress shopping, I'm actually really, really nervous and very fearful about that, because I have to look for a dress that if I do have bloat on my wedding day, what will that look like? There's all of these layers to these happy times that, you know, that you have to think of as somebody living with IBD. But I also want to enjoy my wedding, and all that comes with it, the dress shopping, the hen party, the whatever else comes in between. So I find that, you know, thinking of those upcoming days or days out, I will be nervous and, you know, thinking of what's going on. But is there anything that you would recommend in prep in relation to any milestone coming up that you could give us?
I think optimizing nutrition overall, on the grand scheme of things, making sure that you're eating a well-balanced diet that's anti-inflammatory, lots of plant-based foods that you can tolerate, and keeping that as the norm. And that gives you a little bit of liberty when it comes to a big occasion, because you're keeping yourself well. Prepping for a day out, I would definitely think about where you're going and what's close by. If you kind of think, I don't think I'll be able to eat out on that day, bring food with you, even if it's just snacks like banana and peanut butter or energy balls or some crackers and cheese, things that you like to eat that are nourishing and substantial so you won't go hungry. That can be helpful. Always keep an eye on your hydration, because if you're dehydrated, that can negatively impact your bowel as well. And if you're going with your friends or family, you know that they're trusted people, and that they're aware of your issues, and they can be called upon for help if you have any embarrassing situation or if you struggle at any time point. You know, symptoms can be different for different people at different times of the day. So if you found that you need to be close to the bathroom in the morning time, maybe planning the occasion for the afternoon or vice versa, that can help. The fatigue, I think, is one of the major symptoms that people may struggle with around occasions, and to know your limits. So if you're going to a function or you're going to an event or you're going out, set aside some time before or after the event to rest and check in with your medical team to see what else you can do to help manage things.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Jennifer, to bring you in as well, in relation to that, you know, is there any prep or anything we can do in the lead up to any milestone that we might be having in life to help kind of take a breath, de-stress, as you say, the good and the bad emotions that come in relation to any milestone, that like just wreak havoc on, as both myself and Ruth had mentioned, in relation to our bodies and the impacts it can have?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, I'm just going to kind of take as read all the stuff that people know around stress management, around, you know, all the kind of relaxation and exercise and all that stuff. I'm just going to assume everybody knows that. But one thing I would add to all that learned knowledge is the idea of paying attention to expectations, the expectation of the day, right? It's good to challenge what our expectation is for what our experience should be like. So on one hand, we say, okay, planning a wedding is really stressful. But on the other hand, we say, but I should really have really happy feelings every moment when I'm doing it. You know, that's a very common thing. And the same is true for everything. It's like, you know, what you're describing, Ruth, about the racing. It's like, you're like, guys, you know, talking, I think, to your microbiome, like, guys, this is good. This is a happy event.
Yeah, I have to speak to my body and be like, exactly. Guys, can we just chill out for a second? Like, this is not a good experience. And they're like, no, something's wrong. Like, but it's true. There's a lot of, like, you have to remember to kind of, like, your body's going to react that way, and you can almost predict it in a sense. And like, I'm all exact same Amy is like preparing to the best I can. But there are these pressures, like in racing, if you have sponsors, there's a lot of different things you need to be doing for social media, or you have people down to come see you and you have to try and socialize. And like, it's, I just want to curl up in the ball in the back of the van for 5 minutes after the race to just get my body to wind down. Do you know what I mean? And it's just kind of finding the balance, really, and kind of finding your middle ground and all of the preparation, like what we've all been talking about and everything like that. But it is just trying to get the good out of the situation at the end of the day while managing IBD.
Yeah, but it's getting the good out of it, but it's also, there's a tiny bit around opening to the fact that there's unpleasantness with the good. Do you know what I mean? And that's the story that both of you guys are telling. I mean, that's not a great, super happy message, but essentially, if we're trying to push back against what we're actually feeling, that creates more suffering for us. So the things that I would watch out for are things like guarding, where we're not doing stuff because we're making sure that 100% of the time we can control. You know what I mean? Like, we have to allow for uncertainty, for mistakes, for things to go wrong. So I'd watch out for that guarding reflex of pushing away from life events because it's so frightening, the idea of them going wrong, or if not, even the idea that maybe we wouldn't enjoy them. So push it. That's one thing I would watch out for. And the other thing I would watch out for is like kind of a sense of helplessness around it. I mean, obviously there are things that we cannot control. And that's very true, but it isn't, it's almost all the time, not 100% of the situation. And so kind of what you guys are describing, it's like, I got to prepare for all eventualities and then I got to just jump in.
Yeah. And actually, Ruth, on that, kind of in a slightly different topic, but also very much related to what you're saying, Jennifer, you know, you went through something this year that was connected to your IBD, but I myself, as somebody who's very heavily involved in the IECC and very heavily involved in, you know, talking to people around IBD, never knew was connected to IBD, and that was losing your hair. Can you talk us through, I suppose, that experience, the impact that may have had on your life?
I honestly thought at this stage, after how many years of having Crohn's, that I'd had all the symptoms. Like, you know, we haven't even mentioned like joint pain and like eye problems, like the whole lot. We've all had them. And I was like, oh, I've ticked all the boxes now. We've done them all. And then it was December actually. So it's actually probably coming up to nearly a year now, I'd say next week. I kind of was washing my hair and I got out of the shower one day and I kind of just, my back of my head felt weird. It just felt really soft. And I was like, that's so strange. So I asked somebody to have a look at the back of my head and there was just this big ball patch, like complete just big ball patch. Now, with B12 deficiency and stuff that comes with the Crohn's, I've kind of lost hair before. Like, I've thick hair. I've lost kind of hair before and I've been aware of that and kind of been on top of vitamins and stuff, but never like this. I didn't see this happening. This wasn't something that I was like, oh, I'm losing loads. And it's just all of a sudden, I really didn't realize it. So I was just shocked. Like, I had to get somebody to take a picture because it was right at the back at the bottom and it was just almost like a perfect little birthmark kind of thing. And it was just completely gone, like shiny ball, the softest you'd ever like feel. And I was just shocked. And I just kind of went through a phase of just, I just sat and cried for just a minute, just needed to get it out. And then I was like, right, okay, like what's going on? This was kind of at a point where I'd had, a treatment didn't work. And then I said, oh, I'm going to go au naturel for a year and try and manage it. But I'd gotten progressively worse. Like, I was so fatigued. I was napping constantly. My stomach was terrible. It was really bad. And then this was the final straw. And I was like, okay, I think I need to go and kind of go back to my consultant and see what we can do. So that's what I did. I also did a lot of kind of research then on alopecia and, you know, triggers and everything, but it was very much so related to IBD. And I did actually read about it before. I can't remember, some girl online talking about it. Actually, it was a girl I met through the ICC who had had it. So I did know it was possible, but at the same time, I was, you know, it's once again one of those things where you're like, that's never going to happen to me. So I did everything from, I obviously went back to my consultant then and found a new treatment and touch wood. So like everything's working really well now, nearly a year on. And but I was like, found the right vitamins to take. I was using silk pillows, special shampoo, everything. But it was just a bit of a knock to the confidence. Like, it was at the back of my head, so I was quite lucky. But I was just so conscious because I throw my hair up a lot for racing. I do a lot of mountain biking and stuff, and my hair just goes up. And I was wearing hats all the time. I just got really... just, you know, I was lucky as to where it was, but I still was quite upset about it and self-conscious. And now it's a year on and it's only about, like, I'm going to say like four inches growth, but I'm like, check out my 4 inches, guys. Like,
yeah.
Tail at the back, and I'm so proud of it. Getting there, you know, it is getting there. But yeah.
I can only imagine that was such a difficult thing to have thrown at you, Ruth. And Jennifer, there's a lot of processing in relation to a symptom you hadn't experienced or didn't expect. What advice would you give someone when a symptom catches them off guard?
Oh yeah, that is a really difficult situation. I'm sorry that happened for you, Ruth. I mean, I do think that contact with other people who have the condition is really important at those moments. And reaching out, I think that's one of the really great thing about patient organizations, is that it's because there's so many people, everybody's had something, you know, and so being able to reach out and ask those questions when it's not just a one-to-one with your consultant or IBD nurse or whatever, you know, but people who have the lived experience, I think that is so valuable. Now, what's required before you reach out is being open to reaching out. You know what I mean? And that is essentially, you know, fighting shame and stigma. You know, it's that internal experience of, can I even freaking say this, you know? And so those are two things that are, I think, essentially important to getting support, is like facing that demon of, can I say this? And acknowledging that the question, even the question, is like shame focused, you know, or, you know, it's like, there's something wrong with you that you had this happen to you. And so challenging that and being able to step outside of the experience enough to say, I deserve some help with this. And then actually making the effort to link in with patient organizations. That's the best advice that I can give, because somebody somewhere has had it, you know, and they will. And even if that person doesn't have an answer for you, the very act of the social connectedness and social support treats the shame, which is, you know, the hurdle to get over before asking for even more help.
Yeah, absolutely. But just to kind of get one final piece of advice from all of you with your unique experience, and particularly in relation to milestones, Lorraine, start with yourself. If you have one piece of advice to give somebody who perhaps has IBD a while, or is even just newly diagnosed with IBD in relation to milestones, what would that be?
I believe that the best piece of advice is to become your own expert of your condition. Be an advocate for your own health. Find the information that's relevant, learn about your condition, and ask the questions that you need to ask to help you manage it from your support team. And have a support team, including your doctor, a psychologist, hopefully a dietitian, have family and friends that you can count on to help you get over the tough times, and be gentle on yourself. You're doing your best and you've got challenges to contend with. There's a new interest in food-related quality of life, and this relates to the pleasure and satisfaction of eating. And sometimes, you know, when you eat something that you shouldn't have, you can have a lot of guilt around it and judge yourself. So it's about trying not to experience that. This food-related quality of life is related to recurrence of flares in IBD, reduced overall quality of life and distress with your inflammatory bowel disease, and it's not given a lot of airtime. So as a dietitian, I would say even look at the information online with the Society of Crohn's and Colitis in Ireland or internationally. There's so much really good information on diet, managing stress, optimizing your sleep, etc. If you're struggling, do seek professional support. I know you'd probably think I'm biased, but even just one consultation with a dietitian can be a revelation in terms of what foods you choose and the plan that you can have that suits you, and that can help go a long way. So there, that's my advice.
That's fantastic advice, Lorraine. Thank you so much. And Jennifer, what final advice would you like to?
Well, Lorraine, you kind of took all the advice. So, I mean, the only thing I could add to that, excellent advice. First, my first advice is pay attention to what Lorraine said. And then the second thing I would say is just social connectedness.
Yeah.
Reduce isolation. Even very small contact with people can have an impact on our quality of life. Even just the chat that you have with the person behind the till, the chat with the postal delivery person, you know, even these very small connections can have an impact. And then obviously strong relationships, you know, is the other end of the spectrum, and they also support us so much. So reach out.
Yeah, really, really important advice, especially around milestones. You know, we want to keep up that social interaction. And Ruth, to give you the final word, what advice would you give?
But just to reiterate what Jenny's saying, I think it's so important to be, as if you can, like obviously if you're a private person, try and be transparent in some situations, because I've just found kind of having a voice about having IBD has actually made me find more people with IBD. Like even in motorsport, I have an IBD friend, I call him. And then I'm mountain biking, I have a couple of IBD friends. And like, I find them everywhere because I'm just like, yeah, sorry, I can't do that because I'm doing this because I have Crohn's and stuff. And I just found being transparent and being open about it. And it's not always easy, but I found it hugely beneficial. But my actual own advice would be, I don't know if it's advice, but especially to somebody who's just been diagnosed, I've said it before and I'll say it again, your diagnosis does not define you. Because when I was diagnosed, I was like, I'm the girl with Crohn's. And I'm not. Crohn's actually was just this section of me that ended up fueling me to do all the bigger, better things in my life. And I want people to know that that's a possibility. Like it's you're going to have to adapt, take your time, do everything you need to do. But just remember that it doesn't define you. It's just like this part of you that you're going to learn to own it. And it's going to make you grow. It's not going to make you smaller. It'll make you bigger. If once you do it right, but just have confidence in it and to not let it scare you as much as you can possibly try anyway.
Thank you so much, Ruth. What a fantastic note to leave the episode on. Thank you.
You have been listening to Gutcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, don't forget to subscribe, rate and share. The views, information, or opinions expressed during the Gutcast podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of the Irish Society for Colitis and Crohn's Disease or Janssen Sciences Ireland. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform, and is not a substitute for professional diagnosis or treatment. This podcast is supported by funding from Janssen Sciences Ireland. Participants have been reimbursed for their time.